Next time you're at a football game, the filmmaker Greg Whiteley wants you to look over at the cheerleaders. Now, he knows it's easy to dismiss them, see them as a distraction or an outdated part of American sports. But Whiteley says, look over, because there's a good chance they're the best athletes on the field. Not so long ago, Whiteley discovered this world of competitive cheerleading, kind of a subculture with legends and traditions and tons of drama. And he made a film series about it for Netflix that has become kind of a national phenomenon. It's called Cheer.
I was in Costco and wandering around, and I was looking at big screen TVs. And they were broadcasting the cheerleading championships in Daytona. And the BYU Cougarettes were crowned the national champion. And I was shocked. I had no idea that Cougarettes were considered cheerleaders. And I thought, well, that's incredible. What's this all about?
Run! Get out!
So flash forward 6 years later, and we're in our second season of shooting Last Chance U. And I'm sort of scrambling with, well, how do you make the second season different than the first season? And I noticed that at every game, there are these cheerleaders and there's this amazing band. Well, maybe there's something we could do with them. They practiced at the same time the football team did, but we thought we filmed plenty of football practices. Let's peel off just one camera and go film the cheerleaders. And what we saw just blew us all away. What they were practicing were stunts and routines that we never saw on the sideline of the football game. And they were strangely intense and even dangerous. So when we pressed them on this, I thought, look, A, how come we never see these stunts on the sideline? And B, why are you doing it? And they said, well, we would never do these on the sideline of a football or a basketball game because it would be too dangerous. But Daytona is what this routine is for. The grit, the tenacity, the ability to endure through an injury, the ability to endure through extreme fatigue, the ability to stay mentally sharp after 8 or 9 hours of practice. I've never seen athletes perform at that level. And that just got me interested. There's something about those cheerleaders that could make for a show. Let's start doing some research. What are the top cheerleading teams out there? And if you do just a simple Google search, Navarro Community College would pop up. This tiny community college in Corsicana, Texas. It's about, gosh, hour or so outside of Dallas. And the main driving force of the economy in Corsicana is fueled by Wolf Brand Chili.
How long has it been since you've had a big, thick, steaming bowl of Wolf Brand Chili? Well, that's too long.
And a fruitcake factory.
What started as a small Texas bakery has blossomed into a global mail order business.
And after we talked with the coach, we just felt strong that this was the place we needed to go. So we cobbled together some money and flew out there and filmed for a couple of days. And that just convinced us further that this was something that could be a very interesting documentary series. They're the toughest. They're physically the toughest. They're mentally the toughest.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Greg Whiteley is with us this hour. He directed what has become a classic documentary, New York Doll, about the glam rock bassist Arthur Killer Kane, made a film about Mitt Romney, and this latest project, Cheer, a Netflix series that's been incredibly popular, is, of course, completely different from any of that other work. But he told us there are some common characteristics in the ones that work.
One of the things that I think works in terms of making a good show, not necessarily a hit show, but making a good show, is taking a subject matter that people think they know a little about and have maybe dismissed it, but that show it to them in a way that they go, oh, I really didn't know anything about this. Now, with Cheer, that was easy because I really didn't know much about Cheer until I went to that first practice. And I thought, wow, this is something I don't think the world really fully appreciates. This will be really fun to show them that. Now, embedded in that formula is a bit of a conundrum if you want to make a hit show, because the same reasons that people have dismissed Cheer as an activity are probably also going to dismiss your show when their friend says, hey, do you want to sit down and watch this show about cheer? I've heard it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Go, I don't want to watch a show about cheerleading. And I can't tell you how many people have reached out and said, yeah, look, my boyfriend, my girlfriend sat me down and was going to suggested this show and I had no interest. But, you know, after the first episode, I was hooked. Because in essence, what you're really doing is you're not making a show about cheerleading, for one. You're making a show about these particular personalities and individuals who are involved in the activity, and they are the ones that are carrying the show. Yeah. And so I think whether or not you're a football fan, whether or not you happen to be a Republican or a Democrat, whether or not you happen to have experience with cheerleading and appreciate it or know nothing about it, I hope to tell stories in such a way that it really doesn't matter.
I think – here's what I think and why it – why people are paying attention to it. It's not a reality series. It's a documentary. Like, there's a full-fledged arc, and you craft it the way you've done any of your other documentaries before you did series, it seems to me. And that is what seems to give it this kind of eloquence. And that maybe that's what makes it different from some of the other fare that you get on Netflix, not cutting some of the other stuff. I mean, it's great to have a reality series. Everyone likes those guilty pleasures. But that's not really what this is. This isn't a reality series. It didn't seem that way to me anyway.
The idea of making a documentary series is a relatively new thing. Reality TV, at least in terms of its popularity and reaching the consciousness of most viewers, when you try and pitch a documentary series, it sounds way too much like a reality TV show. Yeah. And the reason why people are reluctant to jump on board and say, yeah, we'll let you come film, is that most people that are participating in a reality TV show in one way or another are made to look kind of silly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know all the ins and outs of that because I've never been involved in a reality TV production. But I know people who do, and the conversations that I've had with them, I wonder if part of it has to do with budget. Reality TV shows traditionally have been made with a relatively lower budget than other non-scripted content. And I think because of the budget, that necessarily necessitates a stricter schedule with which you've got to work. You're confined by, well, we only have so much money, so we can't pay a crew, and so we can only go for so far. And also in reality TV, it's customary, I think, at least when the show becomes a hit, to pay the subjects that they're filming. And when you pay them, it means you get to hand them scripts. You get to give them what time they need to show up to a certain location. When we are doing a documentary series, we try and just embed ourselves in the lives of the people that we're filming. And we try and find out, well, okay, you're going to the hairdresser the next day. Is that okay if we come and film that? And then we go and get permission from the people that own the hair salon, and we make sure that the crew is advanced and prepared, and it will look okay once we get there in terms of lighting. Do we need any extra lighting? We almost never will add extra lighting just because that tends to get in the way of what we're really trying to do, which is capture what really goes on in these people's lives. And so it's a very different dynamic The chief difference is, I think we're able to, in terms of a documentary sensibility, we're able to find a compelling story arc that is pleasing to an audience, not at the expense of our subjects. It doesn't come at the expense of someone's dignity or who they are. Now, we may capture somebody less than their best. We may capture a moment that's unflattering, and we wouldn't shy away from showing that stuff. But we bend over backwards to try and give those moments a proper context. And our aim is that there's never anyone that we film that would come away saying, well, I'm not really like that. That's not who I really am. That was unfair. They put me in those circumstances. They plied me with alcohol prior. So, you know, and there's a number of tricks to the trade in the reality TV show biz, from what I understand. Again, I know very little about it. But I know in the documentary side, we've been successful. And I've been doing this now for a while. And we want to film in such a way that the people that we're filming would have us back to keep filming.
Yeah.
And that's in spite of the fact that sometimes we do film them in some less than great moments, but they always know that they've been treated fairly, maybe even generously.
I think you put it this way. You have to do this with a cold eye, but a warm heart.
Yeah. And I think because of the latitude that a place like Netflix gives us, we can take our time in telling a story, and it allows us to, we see this moment where so-and-so said this to so-and-so, and that's kind of an awkward moment. But if we tell this character's backstory, where you begin to understand who they are, instead of jeering at that person or hating that person, your heart breaks a little bit for that person. Yeah. I think that's where that phrase cold eye but warm heart. We're going to show the stuff. We have to have a cold eye. We're not going to turn away from uglier moments, but we want to show them with the kind of generosity that it's not just treating them fairly. I just think, Doug, it's good storytelling.
Yeah.
I think it becomes even more compelling, more dramatic.
You know, it seems like a pretty decent model for living your life, especially encountering people you don't necessarily agree with or you may not even necessarily like, but if you give it a little bit of empathy, maybe we'd get along a little bit better in society.
You know, I've thought about that. I feel like to tell the kinds of stories that I want to tell in the way I want to tell them, I really feel like I've got to do the best I can to set aside any prejudices, stereotypes, any weaknesses I've got. And the act of being a good documentarian, I think, is just what you just said. It's coming to that project with all the empathy you could possibly muster. I like that. I like how I feel when I'm trying to be a good documentarian. I think you're right. I think it's, for me personally, trying to be a better person also seems to lend itself to telling a better story.
It's Greg Whiteley. He's the creator, the executive producer, and the director of the Netflix documentary series Cheer. Cheer recently won 2 top awards at the 2020 Critics' Choice Real TV Awards. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER wants you to share your feedback about our statewide services. Do you have a question about a program you heard on KUER? How can we better serve the community that you live in? Consider taking a moment to fill out our online feedback form. You can also use this form to send a tip to the KUER newsroom. Write to the station with your feedback at KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, why competitive cheerleading, of course. Actually, this is a conversation with the documentary filmmaker Greg Whiteley about his Netflix documentary series, Cheer. And the series has become wildly popular. It's the story of this cheerleading team from Navarro College in Corsicana, Texas. It's a legit dynasty. They've won the national championship 14 times in the last 20 years. And Whiteley follows the team as they prepare for the 2019 national finals. What is the draw of cheerleading for these young men and women who go into it? What's the thing there? What's bringing them to this?
It's interesting you say that. We focus on a handful of cheerleaders. There's 30 on the team, and we focus on five during season one. In each case, each of those cheerleaders that we focused on, I would say at least four of the five, there was something in their home life, in some cases dramatically so, that was missing. It created a hole that cheerleading filled. Let me tell you one story. So there is a character, a guy named Jerry, and he is he's a cheerleader at Navarro Community College, and he's been cheering for most of his life. He was raised by a single mom. That mom would do anything in terms of working however many jobs she needed to work to make sure Jerry could afford the gym fees and the uniforms to participate from a very young age in cheer.
At the end of my eighth grade year, we ended up getting evicted from our house. We went from like living with friends, in and out of hotels, and we were on like food stamps. But she did what she needed to do to keep me in cheer.
Jerry, for whatever reason, he didn't see himself as a basketball player or a football player, but he is the ultimate teammate. Every human being on planet Earth could use somebody like Jerry, who just is so selfless and pumping up other people around him.
Say sorry, Jay, you're gorgeous! 98 pounds!
I don't even know what I scream. I scream whatever comes to mind at that moment.
Yeah! Whack, 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 whack!
And you have to ask yourself, well, you know, why are you doing this? Because you spend... As a cheerleader, especially if you're at the level of Navarro Community College, you're spending, it's more than a full-time job. It's you're working two full-time jobs just to compete on that team. And let alone staying on top of your studies, obeying a very rigid set of rules, especially when you're in competition season. And you think, well, why put yourself through this? And for Jerry and a number of the other cheerleaders, my sense was cheerleading, is unique. It has this quality to it where people's lives are put in real danger if everybody isn't working together and if everybody isn't choosing. And not only that, the routine itself will fall apart. It won't be what it could be if you're not completely trusting each other. And a lot of those qualities, I think, that go into making a family work, you know, just being a young dad, I extrapolate that, makes a team have to work in a way that I think is different from other sports. In other sports, you're not throwing somebody 30 feet into the air and then hoping that they're caught. Everybody has got to be there for each other. And people that aren't good at that, that aren't showing up and doing their job and being where they need to be and working with other people, setting aside differences or ironing out those differences, they are quickly weeded out of the cheer world. Mm. So by the time you get to Navarro, you have got people that it's in their DNA to just, well, of course, I would crawl through glass to be there for that other person as they're falling from the air, because that's what cheerleaders do.
Ladarius Marshall, he's another one of the young men in the on the squad there. He says, in essence, it's a safe place for people who are hurt. And I'm sure that's not the case for all of them, but it does seem a number of the characters you focus on in season one. I'm thinking of Lexi. Well, you know, go down the list. Morgan, something about them is wounded in some way.
I can't tell if everyone that we film is wounded in some way, and we're sort of uncovering that, or if there is something about cheer in particular where these people that come to it with some wounds that have happened in their upbringing, and cheer has become that safe place.
Yeah, yeah. Because we're all wounded, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all of us could use a little cheer.
Yeah. So you can't tell. You can't tell the whether or not it's they come because they're wounded or that cheer is revealing that part of their life.
You know, Doug, I think that in order to be great, you have to be a little obsessive. And I remember a music critic who was describing a musician we were thinking about doing a documentary about. He said, you know, that musician, they play it off like they don't need to be, you know, that they just have this music and it just comes out, but they don't really care if anybody buys it. He goes, listen, don't buy that. It takes a lot of work to make an album. You weren't just doing this because you didn't care. And I think that may be true of the greatest basketball player that ever lived, Michael Jordan. I think it's true of the greatest cheerleaders that have ever lived. And I wonder if there is just part of that. I think when you add the very real physical risk that is inherent in the sport of cheerleading, it maybe adds a different criterion. You have to not only be obsessive and trying to fill this hole, but there is also a part of you where I wondered sometimes if cheerleaders were willing to risk their lives because their lives had been such a struggle that to them, what's one more risk? I don't know. I'm still trying to unpack it. I'm not a psychologist, but I've thought about these cheerleaders, it's a sport I don't feel attracted to do. I don't have this ambition to be tossed 30 feet in the air. But for these people, it's not only is it something that they're willing to do, it's almost like a part of them would die if they weren't doing it.
What is it about Texas and cheerleading, as far as you can tell?
The simple answer is cheerleading has been historically tied to the sport of football.
Yeah.
And there is no place on planet Earth where football is bigger than Texas. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense that where football is king, cheerleading is queen. And so you have the top gyms in the world in Texas. These are not just, I'm not just talking about college cheerleading teams, although the very best college cheerleading teams, many of them would be found in Texas. And if they're not found in Texas, they're found in places where sports are a big deal.
Well, it brings me to one of the interesting kind of contrasts that you set up in the documentary. This is Corsicana, as you mentioned, and it's a really conservative, small place known for the home of the fruitcake, as you said, and it's conservative. And there's this moment I wanted you to maybe say something about where the new arrivals at this junior college at Navarro are getting this orientation. And this woman is explaining basically this is how Texas works.
All right. Tell me what you think Texans kind of believe politically. The right to bear arms. The right to bear arms? Hell yeah. I'm the biggest gun-toting broad you ever did see. I am packing heat almost all the time. What else? Pro-life, definitely in Texas. You're going to find out relatively quickly that Texas is overwhelmingly a conservative state. They generally support traditional values and lifestyles, so a lot of them are kind of looking at that. A man and a woman is the traditional definition of marriage, and you should get up and go to church on Sundays, and you have the house with the 2.5 children and a white picket fence. The old school people.
Talk a little bit about this moment and the fact that one of the things she says is that she's very free with her opinions, by the way, which I found really interesting. But she talks about how the people here support traditional values, which means a man and a woman. That's a traditional marriage. And there in the audience is probably a gay young man. Talk a little bit about that contrast, because we see it at moments in this documentary.
Yeah. First, I shouldn't even say probably. I think one of the things that I've got to figure out as a storyteller, as a documentarian, is when we encounter a teacher like that, I got to know that teacher a little bit, And part of what she was doing in that first class was giving you a bit of a parody of Texas. And she was sort of, I think, attempting to be in your face. Now, my impression of her is that she is a pretty conservative woman. And I don't want to make too many assumptions about what her actual views are, but I'm taking her at face value when she's saying those things, that she believes those things as well. At the very least, she believes them to be true about Texas. What I worry about is that poor woman, when the show came out, received so much hate online by people who had become fans of the show. Part of the reason is we have done our job as filmmakers in building empathy for these main characters who are cheerleaders. Some of them, as you pointed out, are gay. And so when a woman like that says something and we sense that whatever she's saying might be hurtful to these characters that we now love and we care about, you want to defend them. And so this poor history teacher just received, she had just a very difficult month, from my impression, after the show came out. And I don't know how to, I wish I could help that, because I don't think she's a bad person. I think she was doing her job as a Texas state government teacher. She was simply just trying to say, look, this is the reality of Texas politics. To your broader question, Doug, I was interested to see in this very conservative town, was there any evidence of people being closed-minded towards these cheerleaders, either by way of their just being a male cheerleader, how is that going to be accepted? Yeah. But also, if they were somebody that was gay, was that something that was, were they going to bump into problems? Like, for instance, when they would go to a gas station and they were going to go pick up some gum, would they be treated in a way that was less than hospitable?
Yeah.
I would tell you, I never saw any evidence of that. I couldn't, you know, I didn't look. If we had filmed those moments, they would be in the show. I think what we did see that was an interesting dynamic in this little town in Corsicana was, you can imagine in a town that size, there's not a ton going on. It's an extremely charming town. I loved my time there. But it's not like they've got a minor league baseball team that's going to draw people's attention. The fact that they had the world's greatest cheerleading squad, the world's greatest coach of cheerleaders, right in their own backyard, and they were largely oblivious to it, was fascinating to me.
Did you guys know that Rivera is one of the top collegiate cheer teams in the U.S.?
We did not know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Wow. That is awesome to know that, but I did not know it.
The problem is that cheerleading is both an extracurricular activity and a sport. So there's a constant tension between being the spirit leader for your community, but also being an unbelievable athlete.
The point was made over and over again that these cheerleaders would show up to everyone else's playoff games, basketball games. They would show up to their awards banquets. But when the cheerleaders go to compete for the national championships, it's done, you know, several states away, a time zone away, and now, because of the way things have shifted, it's not even televised. So even if you wanted to, living in Texas, the only way you could do it is to log online and have a subscription to a service that broadcasts the Daytona Championships. And I was fascinated by that. I think, as I pointed out to you, they're not just the toughest athletes I've ever filmed. They're some of the most talented athletes I've ever filmed. And the work that they put into this end-of-the-year routine is nothing, like nothing I've ever seen. And it largely goes ignored, with the exception of other cheerleaders who congregate in Daytona to cheer on other cheerleaders.
Let's talk about Morgan for a moment, a young girl who's basically abandoned by certainly her mother, doesn't have a great relationship with her father. She lives in a trailer with her young brother. She's like 14 years old. She's looking for a family, although she has this great relationship with her grandparents. But Morgan, one of the things you've mentioned is that she has this gift to move through space, which made me wonder, what's the difference between a gymnast and a cheerleader? Like, what's the skill? What's the gift that they possess? What kind of athlete are they, if you can identify?
Well, I think that there's a lot of overlap. And I'm not well-versed in the sport of gymnastics, but I think Morgan, because of the things that you just outlined, had a very tough upbringing. She didn't have access to those kinds of gyms that would prepare you to compete at a place like Navarro. But she's fearless.
In the past, like, game day cheers mostly is what I did. Cheering at football games, basketball games, volleyball games, stuff like that. Didn't really do, like, the competitiveness that we have here. That's, like, kind of, like, what I was, like, hungry for. Like, that's, like, what I wanted to do.
Morgan, stop resisting.
Dude, I'm not. My hamstrings just tightened up.
I wasn't on the mat last year because I don't have as much experience as most of the people on our team. So for me now, I'm, like, a little bit behind where everyone else is at. So I'm just trying to, like, double up on every single skill that I do in the routine to make sure that it's, like, up to par with everyone else.
And because she is fearless, she is willing to try very difficult stunts, very difficult basket tosses over and over and over again until she gets them right. Many times, it's impossible to do those stunts without occasionally being dropped. And when you get dropped from those heights, it leads to injury. And so we saw Morgan competing at Daytona with cracked ribs.
Yep.
And she was hiding that condition from her coach and even from some of her other teammates. And you would watch her over and over again to get a routine perfect, which it needs to be. This is something I didn't realize and I didn't fully appreciate till we began filming. Their entire year is summed up in a single routine that they do at Daytona, and that goes for 2 minutes and 15 seconds. They actually perform it twice. There's a prelim and there's a finals.
Sorry, I want to underline this. They're preparing for 2 minutes and 15 seconds. So in that sense, and this is really a kind of a theme that comes up again and again, it has to be perfect. It kind of has to be perfect because that's it. That's what all the preparation is for, is that moment.
That 2 minutes and 15 seconds in Daytona, that may be your last time that you do cheerleading, the last time in your career.
After college cheer, there is no professional, like, cheerleader where you have this type of cheerleading.
You know, the Dallas Cowboys kind of cheerleaders, those are more so, like, dancers. What we did at Navarro requires a way higher skill level.
If you're lucky enough to cheer at the collegiate level and you graduate, there's no professional team waiting for you. You're done. You're done as a cheerleader.
There are two forces, Doug, that are opposing each other that Monica, the coach, has to navigate. The one is it has to be perfect, like you just said. If there are any mistakes, there's another team that will have performed their routine without any mistakes, and so they'll beat you by virtue of that. The second force is it has to be spectacular. Your routine has to be better than the routine you did last year because you know there's 100 other teams out there that are killing themselves, trying new things, pressing new limits, finding new edges, that if you're not finding the very edge of where you can go, you may do your routine perfectly, but somebody else did an even more spectacular routine and they did it clean, and so they'll win. So Monica is having to juggle that. She's having to press this team to go to places they've never gone before, and then hoping against hope they can, as she puts it, we will practice it and practice it until we get it right, we get it perfect. And then we will practice it and practice it until we can't get it wrong.
Yeah.
And all along the way, because you're doing harder and harder stunts, you're trying as best you can to avoid injury. And it's like you're playing with nitrous. It's just, I think it's a really difficult juggling act.
Let's talk about Monica Aldama. She's such a main figure in the documentary, of course. Probably the greatest cheerleading coach of all time, maybe. I mean, I'm sure people are talking about it like that. But when you first encountered her, when you first met her, thinking about her as being this character in this documentary you wanted to do, did you know it right away that she was going to be great? Because I have a sense that you probably didn't, because she's so subtle. She doesn't come across as necessarily charismatic, even though she's this charismatic force. But I'm wondering, what was the first impression like, I guess, for you?
So we organized a conference call when we had been doing research online and we discovered Navarro Community College. And I got on the phone with Monica and I began talking with her, her AD, and her president. She did most of the talking. And there were two things that struck me. Her keen intelligence jumped through the phone. And the second thing that struck me was her confidence. And it came across this way. There's lots of people that think they would like to be involved in a documentary series. And so I have to walk them through, well, this is what this will mean. In order for us to come and feel comfortable that this is going to be a show that people will want to watch, you really do have to give us access. How do you feel about completely opening up your gym so that we can film any practice that we want to? How do you feel about us filming cheerleaders in their dorm rooms when you're not even there and they're just talking to each other? And so we try and prep them. And I remember her response, and I remember thinking, she said this. She goes, "Yes, I am open to all of that. Come on ahead. We have nothing to hide." I remember thinking, that's really confident. How do you know? I go, I'm pretty good at my job. If there is, you know, something, how can you be so buttoned down that you really feel like, yeah, I can open up all these doors. I'm saying yes to everything. Most people's response, Doug, to that question from me, to that request is, well, maybe. I mean, can we see the footage mm-hmm. when you're done? And the answer to that question is always no. You can't. You need to treat us like you would, say, a reporter for the New York Times who wants to come do an in-depth look at your school. You once were there and we're filming. It's out of your hands. And she did not blink. And so I just thought, I know that I've never had anybody that was just that exuded that much confidence. And I thought, well, this is great. But you're right. I thought she was great flying into Dallas, flying into Corsicana. By the time I left, I realized I had even underestimated her. She is a lot of people, they can feel at first to be too good to be true. She felt a little too good to be true, but the more we got to know her, she was actually even better than that. And what a fun story to tell. What a fun person to have be your central character, or at least one of the central characters of the show, to be someone that's that good. And I've now spent a lot of time with Monica, she is as good as she pretends to be.
You know what I like also is that she didn't come from some other place to make this great cheerleading program. She was born and raised in Corsicana. She married her high school sweetheart who played baseball for the high school team. She went and she wanted to work in Manhattan in a high rise, as her husband says in the documentary. But then she figures, no, I'll stay here and work on this.
That was not obviously in my plan. You know, I had a business degree. I wasn't going to coach cheerleading, but I definitely took everything I learned in business school and used it to build the program.
And then she gets obsessed and she gets kind of addicted to all of it. But she's of that place, which I kind of liked.
Once I started, it was hard to stop doing it. It just pulls you in. It's addicting. It really is.
She's an interesting paradox because she is a fully modern woman.
Yeah.
In almost every definition of that phrase. And yet she's very traditional. She even describes herself as old school conservative.
Yep.
And to me, she tells this story talking about having a hole to fill. Monica, no one's more obsessive than Monica. Nobody works harder than Monica. And I think she had an interesting decision to make when she has a business degree from UT. And she told me that her ambitions were to go to New York. She wanted to be a CEO one day of a Fortune 500 company. And as she began to go down that track, she felt something tug in her heart. You know, she had a high school boyfriend and things between the two of them were getting serious. And I think there was, as she describes it, there was a part of her where she started to imagine a family and how she wanted that family to be raised. And she felt like she was raised under ideal circumstances there in Corsicana, Texas. Mm-hmm. And, I think she just felt like, all right, there's a fork here. There's a decision I have to make. I think I'm going to regret it if I don't go back and honor some of these more traditional leanings I've got inside of me. But some of those more progressive or some of those more ambitious leanings that she had never went away. And she just funneled them into this defunct cheerleading program at Navarro Community College. I don't think they even had a cheerleading program until she got there. I think there was a cheer coach. I think they did, sideline cheer, but I don't think they went and competed at Daytona. And they certainly did not compete for championships. And so I think she's kind of one of those examples of somehow having your cake and eat it too. She became someone that could raise her family under the circumstances she wanted to raise them. And then because of her talent and hard work, she just became a household name for this talent she had as a coach that I don't even think she knew she had.
Hmm. It's interesting to see the reactions to her from just popular culture people who are watching the show. And most of it is kind of along the line of one comment I saw that she's the kind of decision maker America needs, this kind of inspiration, she's tough, that kind of thing. But you do see from time to time, and this gets us to one of the maybe colder parts of the documentary, the more complicated parts of the documentary, and that is the injuries, the concussions, the fact that the intensity of all of that, and whether or not Monica is just inconvenienced by it, doesn't have time for the injuries, that she's emblematic of what may be going on in sports programs around the country, that they sort of look the other way about a sport that could be and is in some cases dangerous.
Y'all get set, let's go.
Here we go. Listen.
Catch her no matter what.
You guys are there, so don't freak out. You guys
You're
are
a Navarro
there.
Cheerleader. You can do it.
It's gonna be tight.
Ready. Hey, focus, please. And one. One, two, three, four. Lean. Seven. And one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Easy. One, three, five, seven, and one, two.
Wow. I'm knocking them out left and right.
Well, I never saw Monica look the other way. I never saw her ignore someone's injury. But I think if you are concerned that Monica could certainly do a lot of things that would make those routines safer, and they would indelibly come at the expense of making them more successful. Like their chances of winning a championship, I think, decrease right alongside the attempts to make them safer. Because to make them safer, you have to do less spectacular stunts, almost by definition.
Yeah, yeah.
So to accuse her of being competitive and driven, she is guilty as charged of those things. And there are, for sure, cheerleaders that do get hurt that they wouldn't have gotten hurt if the routine was not as spectacular, not as aggressive. I will say this, however, that all of those cheerleaders who got injured, and there were a number of them the year that we were filming, more than usual from what I understand. That was the one year that we filmed, and so I don't have anything to compare it to, but I'm told that was above average, but not totally unheard of. And still, these cheerleaders, every single one of them, not one of them is blaming Monica Aldama. Not, in fact, I think if Monica were all of a sudden to pivot and say, all right, this is how we're going to do things from here on out, we may not win as many championships, but every one of you is going to be safe and preserved. I think most, if not all, of the cheerleaders that we filmed would simply choose to go to another school. They handpicked Monica because this is who's going to make me the best cheerleader I can be. And they're on board fully. They're not, nobody's making them do those things, do those stunts.
I liked the comparison to Nick Saban at Alabama. It seems about right. Like you put up with, or Bill Belichick, I think probably comes up too. Like you put up with certain things because you know you're going to not just win championships, but there's going to be an expectation put on you. And that's compelling for some.
Well, Monica's favorite coach is Nick Saban.
Yeah.
She loves the University of Alabama. But she would bring this up with me. She faced some criticism when the show was launched by people that felt she was way too hard on these girls mm-hmm. and these guys. And she brought up, she said, nobody criticizes Nick Saban for being hard on his football players. Mm-hmm. Why are they criticizing me for being hard on these cheerleaders? Mm-hmm. I think it's a good question.
Yeah. Let me ask you... I liked this in one of the reviews of the documentary. Someone mentioned that it was like a metaphor, a larger metaphor for life, like an analog for the struggles of life itself. Just seeing that series play out, the difficulty, the toughness, the idea, the importance of having to set aside, you know, your ego for a larger good. Do you see it that way? Do you see it as a kind of metaphor for that?
I think I know the review you're talking about, and I think that could be true of all sports. Mm-hmm. I think there's something about we sort of look at the arc of a football season, and there's certain lessons that we can extrapolate from that would apply to our lives. I just picked football because I played football.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's true for cheer too. What I think I love, and I think was a life lesson for me, I felt like as I began to understand how the season of a typical cheer team would unfold, it seemed somewhat tragic that you would have these kids who are spending these very formative years putting so much into a 2-minute, 15-second routine that is largely ignored by the rest of the world. And so the question that I sort of wrestled with in my mind is how valuable is that? Is that a worthwhile use of someone's time? And not to give too much away yeah. from the ending of Cheer for people that haven't seen it.
Yeah.
When I finished Daytona and I was around all those cheerleaders and feeling that feeling of they were feeling, and I think it's something you get whether you win or lose. There is just a completion of something very difficult that you were able to accomplish. I remember thinking to myself, it's too bad everyone can't feel this feeling at least once in their life. This feeling of giving everything, risking everything for this thing that you've at least for right now have determined is going to be bigger than yourself. I am giving myself to it. And we are going to complete this task. And whatever the results may be, we're going to go at it with all of our hearts. And then if you combine that with just years of honed talent, it produces a moment that I think is perfect. And I think most of us live lives never having that feeling. And it's the fact that they get it, and even if they get it at 19 or 20 and they're never going to get it again, at least they had it once.
Greg Whiteley, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Greg Whiteley. He's the creator, the executive producer, and the director of the Netflix documentary series Cheer. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tue, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.